Welcome back to the Global Greek Influence, the podcast that takes you on a journey through the dynamic world of global Greeks in the realms of technology, cutting-edge scientific and engineering innovation, entrepreneurship and business, also special topics on politics and history. I'm your hostess, Panayotis Pimenidou, and I'm thrilled to have you join us once again. If you want to stay updated and never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe, like, and review the Global Greek Influence podcast on your favorite podcasting platform, such as Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, and more. Your support means the world to me. For even more engagement, be sure to follow our podcast's Twitter account, Facebook page, and LinkedIn page. It is the best way to stay up to date with the latest episodes, connect with me directly, and even suggest topics you would love to explore. But wait, there is more. For just €2.99 a month, you can unlock a world of exclusive content. By becoming a premium subscriber, you will gain access to exclusive video episodes available only on Spotify, get sneak peeks of upcoming interviews, and enjoy special episodes that dive deep into fascinating topics. So get ready to immerse yourself in the captivating stories and influential figures that have shaped the global Greek influence and impact the world today. Join us on this exciting journey of discovery and celebration. Thank you for being part of the Global Greek Influence community. Today I'm with Vasilios Rizos, Research Fellow and Head of Sustainable Resources and Circular Economy at CEPS, the Center for European Policy Studies. Vasilios' professional journey began at the Agricultural University of Athens in Greece. While the Agricultural Economics Program of Study was a demanding program and provided him a solid knowledge in the field, Vasilios wanted to extend his knowledge to adjacent fields and decided to do a master's degree abroad. In particular, Vasilios found inspiration in the environmental sustainability modules, which motivated him to look for postgraduate studies in that area. He considers himself fortunate to choose the University of Edinburgh in the UK and the master's program in ecological economics, as it provided him with a new perception of how the economic system interacts with the environment, and many of the elements of the program were forward-looking. Most importantly, Vasilios still blends ideas for the master's program in ecological economics during his work on EU environmental policy. With Vasilios today, we will discuss the potential of emerging sustainable technologies and their impact on sustainability and the environment, innovative approaches and strategies that can help us transition to a more sustainable and circular economic model beyond recycling, the emerging trends in green transition jobs, and discuss whether traditional reskilling methods are sufficient or if alternative approaches are needed to equip individuals with the necessary skills for these fields. Recent success stories in the development of EU circular business models that can serve as inspiration for businesses looking to adopt circular practices. The lessons that can be learned from the EU's efforts to establish a sustainable and slave-free battery material supply chain, how governments and policymakers can take decisive actions and implement effective policies to expedite the transition towards a sustainable and circular economy, the successful initiatives and practices that have been implemented in EU countries or regions to promote circularity and sustainable resource management. Welcome to the show, Vasilia.
Pleasure, Panagiota. Thank you for the invitation. And very good to be here.
When discussing with people of my immediate social and family circle, it comes across as a common perception that a regenerative and waste-free circular economy is about recycling and is often seen as postponed from year to year based on policies and targets. Citizens may feel that policies and targets set by governments and organizations are not always effectively implemented or enforced. This can lead to a sense of frustration and skepticism about the pace of change. Professionals, on the other hand, believe that policies and targets should be ambitious, transparent, and regularly evaluated to ensure progress is being made. Beyond recycling, how can we move from a linear take-make-dispose model to a truly regenerative and waste-free circular economy?
Very good question. It can take a lot of time. I'll try to give some hints. But I know that it's very good to know, first of all, that people, you know, in your social circle, but in general public, is becoming increasingly interested in this concept. And also that people start thinking beyond the traditional forms of using resources more efficiently, which are basically recycling and waste and managing waste when a product has reached its end of its life cycle. So the thinking has to go beyond recycling and waste. You're very right in this. And I think in general, if you look into the European Union policymaking, the thinking has moved beyond recycling. And I will get into details on this later. But mainly, let me start by saying that I find this very exciting that people speak about circular economy these days, because in essence, it is an academic concept. You know, it originates from academic circles. There are a lot of theories and interpretations, of course, but it comes from academic circles, and it's not so often that you see a concept, a theoretical and abstract concept that originates from academic circles to really reach mainstream, you know, discussions. I think I find this exciting, and I think it's a very good moment to discuss this. And let me start by saying that I'm not sure personally that we will ever reach the stage to say we are now in a fully circular economy that is waste-free and truly regenerative. And I would say this for the simple reason that, you know, it is an abstract concept. You know, it's something that evolves over time. You know, while we gain more knowledge, while we have researchers and academics, you know, doing assessments about how our economic system functions and how are we using resources, our interpretation of what is really a truly sustainable, a regenerative system might evolve in the future. So how we define it today might be different in the future. So I don't think that it will be feasible to find one single indicator, if we speak about metrics, that we'll be able to use in the future to say that we have a truly circular economy. Of course, there are some foundations and organizations that they have developed such metrics, but there is a degree of subjectivity in it, if you understand what I mean. But let's say that if we take the Paris Agreement, you know, we have the Paris Agreement, a global agreement on climate change, as a starting point, that we need to achieve we need to achieve a net zero economy, a carbon free economy. You know, if I can use a term, or a net zero, I think actually that's a more accurate term. That in this economy we have as little waste as possible. I think that will entail a major change in the economy. I mean, we will need to see very ambitious changes across a wide spectrum of sectors. And we will need to ultimately think of how we produce and consume things. And this is not going to be something easy, not something that will happen overnight. Now, imagine to achieve a major change in our consumption and production patterns that will need, first of all, innovation. I think that's the key word here. And we will need innovation, first of all, technological. We will need new technologies or bringing technologies that are now at the laboratory scale to the market. But we'll also need organizational innovation in companies, organizations, in NGOs, in think tanks like the one I'm working in. And also we'll need to see governance innovation in governments at all levels, European Union level, national level, and regional level. And of course, in the end, you will also need to have citizens on board, like your social circle that you referred to earlier. We will need education. We will need to explain people, and it's good to know that this is already happening. That by simply encouraging certain actions, like the simple things, like taking the waste in the right bin, you know, this is really the minimum, the absolute minimum, and this is really in the right direction. But in order to achieve change, we need to make people knowledgeable. We need education here. That basically there will be a need for fundamental changes in our Western world economies to achieve this more sustainable or secular future. And that will take time. But if you start at the early stages of education, I think you can, you know, this is an idea that can be gradually be embedded in people's minds. I hope it wasn't too long. Okay.
Not at all. Many individuals and businesses face a skills gap when it comes to green jobs. The transition to a sustainable economy requires specialized knowledge and expertise in areas such as renewable energy, energy efficiency, circular economy practices, and sustainable technologies. Access to quality training and education programs is crucial to equip individuals with the necessary skills for these emerging fields. Are there any trends in green transition jobs? And should we rely solely on traditional reskilling methods, or should we explore alternative approaches to equip individuals with the new skills necessary for these fields, rather than relying on the old clothes training format?
Very good question as well, Panagiota. And first of all, the pace of innovation is quite fast. And I think we can see this in many different phases of our lives. and aspects of our daily life. And I think digital technologies are quickly coming into play and they're changing a lot of our daily habits. And of course, this will entail also major impacts on the job market. And think about the typical example of jobs in the recycling sectors. I mean, when you think of this, of recycling sectors, you might think sometimes of large scrap yards, you know, when you see their electronics or cars. I'm sure you've seen them in your area. Or you might see, or you might think of, you know, major plants where they where feed, you know, waste or products, these plants, and then, you know, sometimes there's energy recovery. It's called incineration, basically burning of waste to produce energy. Or you treat waste in order to produce some byproducts. Now, these are the traditional jobs in the recycling sectors, but with digital technologies coming into play, we will be seeing new tools that will change or improve some of these processes. Now, think about the digital product passport. I mean, you know, we can discuss a lot about it. Basically, it's a QR code that will be included in certain products, starting with batteries, you know, the batteries that we'll be having in electric vehicles. And that QR code will provide, let's say, a picture about the battery, you know, its lifetime, its performance, its resources. And basically, the digital passport will also be used to track materials and bring them back to the right supply chains, including recycling supply chains. So in the end, some of these processes will be manual, but, you know, there will be a lot of, you know, use of digital tools in between. And you know, some of these people that will be implementing these tools, you know, they will be working perhaps in the recycling sector or in the resources management, if we use the right term, not waste, but resources, in the resources management sector. So imagine this, we're talking about new skills. It's not like the traditional form of recycling job that we that used to exist, or it will continue to exist, but with different skills and different mindset. So we need to have forward-looking thinking in that respect, and of course include new curriculum programs in universities, encourage young people to follow such degrees. I think, of course,
you mentioned about academic curricula, and coming from an academic background and having been a program leader for the BEngineering in chemical engineering in the United Kingdom, I could see how slowly and carefully academic curricula need to be designed and built, especially if they have to be approved or accredited by professional bodies like the Institute of Chemical Engineers in that instance, and how slow the administration can be in universities when it comes to the adoption or keeping up to date to market and industry needs. Instead of changing the curricula, the academic curricula, the accrediting bodies to approve certain degrees with specialities if a student has completed a certain research project or has completed successfully a workshop or a seminar with some practical work. So this could be a solution for upskilled and reskilled graduates from academias across Europe, for instance.
I think that this is a good idea. And in general, trying, you know, there are a lot of bright students that they're already, you know, doing this on a practical level, you know, on engineering jobs, for example. And I think that in some departments, there are European Union-funded projects which can give opportunity to the basically the lead professor to use some of these resources that exist in his or her department, including giving the opportunity to students to jump in them and get some practical experience. I think this is something we have seen in different projects that I've been part of as well. And I think, yeah, we need to give a credit to the European research funded projects. They have really, I think they have made an impact. And you mentioned the United Kingdom where you studied. And I also need to give a credit here to the United Kingdom, because indeed, it, you know, I studied in the United Kingdom as well. And they already started putting forward a lot of programs on sustainability, you know, ahead of its time in a way. And in some cases, you know, being forward-looking, try to experience trends in the market and then integrate this in the curriculum programs, I think it can make a difference. And you need forward-looking thinking, but you also need innovation, like what I explained earlier, and innovation also in educational systems, and not just sticking to the old programs or to the old structures we have also in university curriculum programs.
What one needs to understand is that in the UK, the engineering programs last for 3 years. So it's crucial to make sure that engineers from any discipline who graduate and who are ready to be employed in the industry have all the necessary theoretical knowledge and background to work in different fields. So I cannot see how we can pack more compactly the 3 years. So in that sense, there can be some changes in how awards are given rather than changing the curriculum, where especially in undergraduate studies, some certain degree of knowledge has to be covered.
Yes, that's an interesting suggestion. And as you said earlier, Panagiota, you need also strong theoretical foundations. And that's something we should keep in mind. So even if the market moves or technology evolves in the future, you need to have some certain theoretical foundation. You need to have some basic courses that give you a strong background in the beginning, and of course some flexibility later to adapt. It's a long discussion, but I'm also not in favor of contesting things, you know, within a curriculum program and in a very short period. I think for certain degrees you need time to get into the different technical and theoretical issues, which are important. Yeah.
You mentioned some success stories in incorporating industrial and practical experience across the European Union and in the UK. And we all know that success stories showcase the achievements and accomplishments of individuals or businesses which have overcome challenges and achieved their goals. And such success stories often highlight the strategies, approaches, and lessons learned by successful individuals or businesses. Now, success stories in the development of EU circular business models can serve as inspiration for businesses looking to adopt circular practices and simultaneously create a positive environmental impact. Also demonstrate that circular business models can be economically viable and environmentally sustainable and can work. What recent success stories in the development of EU circular business models can serve as inspiration for businesses looking to adopt circular practices and simultaneously create a positive environmental impact while boosting their bottom line?
Yeah, certainly we see a lot of good examples recently in Europe. And actually, we were part of an endeavor that took place in 2016 as part of a European Union-funded project named Green Economy at the time, to really create a mapping of businesses that they try to implement circular or sustainable practices. And, you know, I remember at the time we found so many good examples of innovations that maybe even at the time they weren't even being perceived as secular innovation, which is now the term we're using very often. Maybe I can give a couple of examples in different sectors. And first of all, one sector that has a lot of impact, of course, is electronics, you know, the electronics industry and our electronics consumption in Europe is very high. But we've seen in recent years a growth of reuse and repair models for high-end electronic products. You know, we've seen, I'm sure you've been in a smartphone store recently, and maybe you've seen like refurbished models being sold, you know, in the store. That's something we hadn't seen in the past. So we've seen people being interested to buy a refurbished model as long as they can get, of course, a guarantee for this model. And in that sense, that gives to the product a whole new life. So the smartphone market, I think, is a very good example, because at least a couple of years ago, when we looked into the figures, the statistics, it was the refurbished segment of the mobile phone market was the fastest growing segment at the time. So you can imagine that this brought a lot of opportunities to companies, small companies, that they will offer these kind of products to their clients in Europe. And that will bring, of course, economic benefits, a model, a business case, basically, together with environmental benefits. And then, of course, that expands to other products, for example, tablets, laptops. It's not necessary today if you can get the guarantee from the store that to buy a new product when it comes to electronics, then, or the latest model always. You know, that was a trend maybe we saw a couple of years ago, but now there is really a growing segment of consumers that will look into refurbished models. So, and that's what the statistics say as well. So I think that's one good example. And then, of course, combining digital technologies with sustainability principles, I think this is the key let's say, this will be one of the most innovative ideas that we'll be seeing in the future. We are already seeing, actually, in different sectors. I mean, I don't want to mention names of companies, but I've seen, for example, in the textiles sector, one of the examples of companies that they have implementing QR codes in the textiles product. And then basically through the QR code, they can track the product and already provide an incentive to the consumer to return the product. And at some point, they can reuse the textile product or reintroduce it in the production process. So, and that's important because the production of textile waste in Europe, you know, it's also another important issue that now needs to be tackled with. And we have a European Union strategy on textiles, actually. And of course, you've seen like similar apps and popping up in different sectors. For example, there were apps encouraging the use of food waste or encouraging using, let's say, leftovers from stores or from supermarkets. This is something in one other innovation that I saw a couple of years ago. So really bridging the gap of information. I think this is one of the key functions that all of these digital tools and applications, they function. You know, imagine you're a consumer. You're not even aware that there is, you know, that there might be a supermarket, that they have like some products, that they have a short expiring date, but they're still, you know, they can be still used and they might be left over or thrown away. You know, you might not even know there is this opportunity. So by having this access to information, you can, you can get motivated to buy these products. And that goes also to the business-to-business environment. You know, you might be a company that is interested in finding certain components for your product. It could be like electronics in the electronic sector or in another industry, but having access to information about where the component is or what is the quality of the component. You know, this really brings down barriers. You know, barriers we have in supply chains, barriers we have of information. You know, and I think there are a lot of opportunities and things that we haven't still seen yet, because you know there's really a lot of innovation in this sustainability and digital nexus.
Circular economy is about closing the cycle, in a sense, of where a material is sourced. When it's shipped, it's used in a production line for a specific product, then consumed, disposed, and then in order to close this cycle, we need to reuse it, to reinstate its original capacity, in a sense. Of course, most of us, when it comes to circular economy, might think of water, food, but we are using some scarce materials that are hard to find. Therefore, they're very expensive and sought after, especially in energy applications, renewable energy applications. So recently, the EU conflict minerals regulations aimed to prevent the financing of armed groups through the trade of minerals, including those used in batteries. Additionally, the EU non-financial reporting directive require companies to disclose information on their supply chain due diligence efforts, including measures taken to prevent forced labor and human rights abuses. What lessons can be learned from the EU's efforts to establish a sustainable and slave-free battery material supply chain, particularly in relation to the implementation of the digital battery passport and the experiences of existing pilots within the EU?
Good question. And again, we're entering the discussion about the nexus between digital and digital technology and environmental sustainability. And here we add the social angle, which is very important. And I think this is really what the digital product passport represents. But let me start by saying that basically, I think that the introduction of this tool you mentioned, a digital product passport, can really provide lessons about how digital tools can be used to address long-term challenges, because the lack of transparency across supply chains, the lack of knowledge of you know, products that we see in supply chains has been really one of the most important barriers that has been identified in almost every single academic publication on circular economy in recent years. So almost every paper you will be seeing talking about challenges to implement circular economy will be talking about lack of transparency, lack of data across supply chains, that we don't know where the product comes from, what it includes. And I think this tool, the digital product passport, that will be mandated first for batteries, if properly implemented, it really holds potential to have an impact across global supply chains. First of all, you mentioned the due diligence requirements and the conflict mineral zones, and if properly implemented, this tool will shed light into where the material comes from, and will also provide some form of reassurance that basically the materials in products, in electronics, in batteries do not originate from conflict zones where there has been a military conflict or where there is child labor involved. So I think this is an important contribution, and of course, beyond the social aspects, there is an important environmental sustainability dimension, because as I explained earlier, the product passport will provide transparency or clarity about what materials are in batteries, you know, the first product group, and what chemical substances are included in the product, but also what is the state of health of the product. And basically, that will then support recycling, efficient recycling of battery or reuse of the battery. So ultimately, the digital product passport will be an enabler, a tool to serve circular economy business models that will be seen growing in Europe in the future. And actually, you can already see a proliferation of business models and business cases that they try to already implement the digital product passport. They try to already, of course, approach the industry and inform them we can already help you prepare for the mandatory requirements. And there are a number of companies that claim that they can already implement full transparency across supply chains. I think through a basic Google research, you will find a number of companies doing this. And as I said earlier, you know, batteries will be the first product for which we will be having a mandatory product passport. And there are a lot of pilots. And actually, SEPS, my organization, is part of a pilot project, Horizon Europe-funded project that develops and implements a digital product passport for batteries. And we can already see some lessons learned or some messages, and maybe I can give a hint about them. So, yeah, perhaps not to your surprise, Panayota, there will be some challenges. You know, it's not going to be that we're going to wake up, you know, the day after and the supply chains will be fully transparent and we'll be having all the data. You know, there will be some challenges. We can already see them. And first of all, companies are not used to share data that are outside of non-disclosure agreements. That's important to keep in mind. And of course, you know, changing the mindset in a large company is not easy. It will take time. Even if you tell them that it will be mandatory in the coming years, it cannot happen overnight. So that's one of the key challenges we are seeing in the project, basically convincing layers across the supply chain, the battery supply chain. You might imagine the battery has so many components. So there are so many players across the global value chain, and you have to convince all of them to share data. So that will be one of the challenges. Then, of course, there are technical complexities, and here, of course, somebody with a technical background will be able to understand that. Of course, in order for this data to be useful, they need to be shared in the same format and under a standardized process. So we need this process, and we need time to implement them, and that will be another challenge. And finally, of course, there's the question of validation. So even if you have this data, how can you ensure that basically they are reliable? Like when you have data about the carbon footprint of the battery, say, or even the components in the battery, how can you put in place the processes and the validation, let's say, procedures to ensure that this data is reliable? That's another concern that people have in the supply chain. That's another challenge that we are seeing. But of course, you know, no change can be is easy and will happen overnight, as I said earlier.
EU member states have the flexibility to develop their own policies and strategies to implement circular economy principles. This can lead to differences in the prioritization, scope, and pace of circular economy implementation across countries and regions. Which countries or regions are leading the way in implementing circular economy strategies, and what lessons can be learned from their experiences?
Yeah, first, Panayota, let me start by saying that most of the European Union members at this stage have a dedicated circular economy strategy or a circular economy roadmap. And I find this quite remarkable, because there's no obligation at the European Union level or recommendation to the countries to prepare their strategy. So they went their own way and they presented the strategies, which shows how popular it's becoming also in national policy agendas. So, and of course, at the European Union level, we have circular economy strategy since 2015. So we are approaching 10 years, actually, since the first circular economy action plan. So if you look at the European Union, I think that we can claim that when it comes to policy setting or policy objectives, we are quite advanced. And we, beyond the strategies, we have seen some ambitious, let's say, targets or objectives or tools in different member states that maybe we haven't seen elsewhere. And maybe let me start by saying, for example, in the Netherlands, I've seen that they have put some concrete targets just to give an example, to introduce circularity criteria in a certain share of public tendering procedures. You know, this is something I don't think we have seen in other countries so far, at least me. Maybe there has been, but I thought this is quite remarkable to have a quantitative target for this. You know, and that can really have an impact. Imagine the municipalities in your region that whenever they put a tender for any kind of issue in their area, to really integrate circularity principles in the tender. You know, that can really have an impact on the market. Then, of course, we have seen some ambitious economic incentives for repair products in Sweden. That's something that happened a few years ago, but I haven't seen any assessment of the impact, to be honest. But still, it was pioneering at the time. And then France has been also quite progressive in terms of setting a repairability index for products. So basically a scoring mechanism for products. So a consumer, when the consumer will choose an electronics product, to know what is the repairability performance for the product. You know, how in future years, how can it compare when it comes to repairability with another product of the same, you know, say, line, let's say. So these are some ambitious tools, and I think they can give good messages. I'm not sure if they can necessarily say that these countries are pioneers in circular economy, because that's very complex. But I can say that they're pioneers in terms of putting in place some ambitious policies. Now, it's good to discuss about the positive things, but we also have to look into the impact of our process in Europe. And if you look into the statistics, we are really a long way to go. Now, recycling rates may have improved in certain parts of Europe, in central northern Europe, certainly, but they really are. Our economies are very consumption intensive. We are consuming a lot. We should keep this in mind. And especially now that this has been almost 10 years since we have been talking about circular economy in Europe, at least at the political level, we need maybe to look into the other side of the picture, our consumption side. We need to give more emphasis on this part of the picture. And just to give you a practical example, is that every European citizen produces 16 kilograms of electronic waste per year. And okay, we recycle quite a good share of it, around, I think, 43%. This is statistics from a UN report published a couple of years ago. But still, it's a very high figure, knowing that in Africa, an equivalent citizen will produce 2.5 kilograms of e-waste. You know, it's a massive difference. And imagine if the African citizen in the future, in the coming years, will produce the same amount of e-waste per year. We're talking about massive amounts of products we need to be dealt with in the future. And massive amount of resources we need to extract to produce this figure. So there's a long way to go. It's a complicated discussion, and it's not going to happen overnight. And I know that sometimes people are impatient, like the people in your social circle you mentioned earlier, but it will be a long process, certainly. Yeah.
I'm afraid it's beyond my social circle, Vasily. I can read many of, especially anonymous users' opinions on Twitter. And they are extremely harsh when it comes to the circular economy. They think that it's something fictional, something made up, addresses only a certain percentage of citizens in this world. Many countries and regions, including the EU, rely on energy imports, which can create dependencies on specific regions or countries that are major energy producers. This can lead to geopolitical tensions and vulnerabilities in energy supply chains. Enhancing resource optimization and reducing dependence on authoritarian regimes for critical resources, such as energy and raw materials, can enhance the EU's resilience and security. By diversifying energy sources, developing domestic renewable energy capacities, and promoting resource efficiency, the EU can reduce its vulnerability to supply disruptions and geopolitical tensions. In a world experiencing growth resource scarcity, how can the EU enhance resource optimization, promote resilience, and foster a sustainable future while reducing dependence on authoritarian regimes beyond Russia, including Azerbaijan?
Certainly, Panagiota, the world we are living today is quite different compared to 2 or 3 years ago. We have to be honest with ourselves. There have been a lot of geopolitical tensions, and of course, the war in Ukraine has changed the mindset in Europe and beyond. It's a different geopolitical landscape. And the question you are asking about how we can reduce our dependence while sustain resilience is a complex and multifaceted question. So I will try to give some hints here. First of all, I think there is currently at the European Union level a major endeavor to basically reform our policy framework on raw materials. And basically, we are in the process now of negotiating the Parliament, and the European Parliament and the Council, a new piece of legislation, which is called the Raw Material Act. That will be the first piece of law at the European Union level focusing on raw materials. Now, how can we, you know, and I think that actually process gives a lot of messages about what could be the plausible future for the European Union and what should be the actions that we should take. And of course, addressing the consumption side, I think it's one part of the story, as I mentioned earlier. You know, by consuming a lot, by consuming the same way, maybe that's the correct expression, the same way, you know, that brings a lot of challenges also of dependence. So we will need to still think of our consumption patterns, but irrespective of this, we will still need new technologies producing, having new technologies in Europe. We will need to have a renewable energy expansion in Europe. And of course, renewable energy technologies are material intensive. And this is, of course, the elephant in the room. So we need materials. We need materials and maybe in a much higher intensity compared to the past. So how are we going to achieve this? How are we going to basically reduce our dependence while sustaining the resilience, while we need more materials, perhaps, compared to what we thought a couple of years ago? Now, first of all, of course, we should build partnerships with other parts of the world, with other countries, with countries that are resource rich. I think that's one of the first key answers. And we need to have a portfolio of partnerships. And I think that, you know, relying on one single country for one certain stream of products, and imagine if we're talking about low carbon technologies, quite important stream of product or technologies, you know, entails a lot of risks. I think there are a lot of lessons learned from our dependence on Russian gas in previous years. So we need partnerships, and I think the EU is already taking action in this direction. And if you look into the news, there have been already a couple of partnerships announced recently. So this is one part of the story. Then, of course, we need to develop our own biochains in Europe. And of course, for this, we need skills. As we mentioned earlier, we need, you know, young talent, and we need to establish the biochains in Europe. And in certain cases, these biochains are almost non-existent at the moment. So imagine the challenge involved in this process. Just to give you an example, permanent magnets is something that, you know, I didn't know a lot about it a few years ago, but at CEPS, we started doing research on it a few years ago. And now we're quite deep into it. Permanent magnets are important components in low carbon technologies due to their magnetic properties. For example, electric vehicles, wind turbines, but they're also used in electronic products and in defense applications. So they're very important. And they're based on rare earth elements, which are critical raw materials that, you know, that can be supply risks in the futures. And now we don't have this value chain in Europe. We try to build it at the moment. And basically, we depend entirely on China for permanent magnets. So now you can imagine the risks involved in this dependence. So basically, we will need to build our own industry, and the industry is at the infancy level at the stage. So this will take time. It will be a challenge. But this is another how we can address this dependence. And finally, and that's the last point in this question, we will need to open the Pandora box about extraction of resources in Europe and using our own resources. And that has two dimensions. The first dimension is the sensitive one. It has to do with public acceptance. I think you know this. In Greece, it will be very difficult to open a new mine in your backyard or in any region. And that makes sense. People are sensitive about natural environment. There can be impacts. Of course, we can claim in Europe we have high environmental standards, but there's still an impact. But then there's an ethical question here. You know, for many years or decades, we really relied on other parts of the world to get these resources for us. I mean, you buy a smartphone, you buy a laptop, you buy a car, and the material in many cases comes from another part of the world. I mean, is this really ethical that we will be just not taking our own share of responsibility in Europe? So if we want to sustain these living standards, you know, that has an impact on the natural environment because the resources need to come from somewhere. And I think that we need to take a good share of this responsibility as well. So that's quite an important Pandora box that will generate a lot of discussions, maybe even in Greece in the coming years.
Well, even though we want to become resilient when it comes to resources that we use in our industries, in our everyday lives, in renewable energy, we have to think carefully and strategically what types of partnerships and coalitions we form. We have partnerships with North African countries to import, for instance, solar energy.
Recycling can help reduce this dependence, absolutely, because you get resources out of the product, you can reduce them in the process. We have done some calculations at CEPS, taking different product groups, for example, and the key technologies, batteries and wind turbines, and we did some calculations to see if in the future we develop our own recycling processes in Europe, what share of material demands for these product groups we could cover through recycling. And the results in some cases are encouraging. but still a big part of the picture, a big part of the share of demand for the future, we need to come from virgin resources, because recycling will only cover part of the material demand. And in some cases, it can reach up to 50%, maybe for electric vehicle batteries by 2040, maybe in some cases, but still a lot of materials will need to come from virgin sources. So you cannot just imagine a future where we will just be taking the batteries that will be reaching end of life and there take the materials and produce new batteries, for the simple reason that for a period of 20, 20, 30 years, the battery production product will explode. You know, the growth in demand will be so high that, you know, you will be needing a lot of materials. And of course, in the future, of course, that might be flattened a little bit, but we're talking about now until 2013, 40. Okay, so recycling can be part of the picture, but you will need resources. And then partnerships are important. And you mentioned Africa. And of course, there is the question of in non-stable political regimes, but we also need to keep in mind that Europe has a history of colonialism with Africa. Plus, a lot of, you know, in the past, there was a relationship, let's say, or the perception that Europe will only care about extracting the resources from Africa and using them for our own sake without creating any added value in Africa. And I think that mindset now has changed, and we see now a different form of effort by at the European Union level as well. So we want to create partnerships with African partners, help them through some skills transfer, through some technology transfer, to also build their own value chains, and all that will also support their economic prosperity, and then also support us with material demands, but more in a partnership kind of framework rather than us taking the materials from them. And that's not something that it's socially acceptable any longer these days. So a complex discussion, but there are a lot of issues involved, as you can imagine.
At the same time, let me add here that maybe our future materials, the ones that we use now, might come from space, or we might find more exotic materials from space and not be so dependent on our Earth resources. One last question, Vasilije. Political parties play an important role in policymaking within the EU. They formulate and advocate for specific policy positions which can shape the direction and priorities of EU policies. The EU Parliament, as an elected body, can be a strong advocate for progressive policies. The next elections in June 2024 will influence the composition of the Parliament and affect the climate policies and other important issues. What are the key challenges that the EU is expected to face in the coming years regarding circularity and sustainable use of resources, considering the upcoming European elections and the start of a new political cycle?
Very good question to conclude with, and very relevant, because Panayota, very often you hear in, I guess I hear in my discussions, maybe that's the suggestion, you know, in your case as well, that European elections feel so distant. What happens in Brussels feels so distant compared to national politics or national situation, and that might be demotivating people, a factor for people to vote. But really, you know, what happens in Brussels can have a direct or indirect influence in your life. And just to give the practical example, as I mentioned earlier, the negotiation now in the Parliament and the Council of the Raw Material Act, the first law on raw materials, you know, that's happening through the committees in the Parliament and through, you know, elected representatives in the Parliament. So certainly, your vote has an impact. So people need to vote, and they need to look into the program of different parties in order to make the decision. I hope that in most cases, environmental sustainability, together with this whole new geopolitical dimension, will be high on the agenda of candidates. Now, what do I see as key challenges? And that maybe, you know, give some inspiration to people what they could look for. In different programs is, first of all, one of the key challenges is how do you actually combine this environmental sustainability question you mentioned earlier with the question of securing raw materials for the future and sustaining our living standards in Europe. I think this is really the key question, because following the war in Ukraine, we have to go faster when it comes to renewable energy installations in Europe. We have to, and that, of course, has climate benefits. Of course, you know, you have more renewable energy, that you decrease your emissions, but that has in direct or indirect impact on natural environments. Because if you go faster, there could be some risks in some cases of not having the proper process in place or not assessing all of the different impacts. So this is kind of a very difficult equation for researchers and for politicians. And I think this is something that at least we should reflect upon, we should discuss, we should be open about. And that also reflects the interest of the candidates as well. So I think this is a key question that we need to be addressed in the next political cycle. How do we actually accelerate the pace of growth of renewables without compromising our environmental standards in Europe and without not having a major impact on natural resource and environment? I think that's the first key challenge. The second is, of course, linked to the raw material demands, as I said, in the future. We know what are we doing on the front of mining. Can we actually educate people about the need to develop some mining under high environmental and social standards in Europe? Can we educate people? Can we be open to the citizens about that this might be needed in the future and there will be impacts? I think that's one of the key challenges, because we need the materials now. We don't need them like in 10 or 20 years, you know, for when the new generation will be born. I mean, we need the materials basically now in the coming years. And you know, this is again a very difficult equilibrium to solve. And finally, the final point links to the raw material. But I mean, one of the key challenges will be to convince our partners around the world, both in developing and developed countries, about that we are, you know, that Europe offers opportunities, certainly, that is still a region that has high environmental standards, high social standards, but still can offer opportunities for partnerships, and that we are a reliable partner. I mean, we have achieved this, of course, in the past, but now the raw material challenge brings a whole new discussion into place, because there are other players, other economies, that are also looking for these materials, that they are also face the same scarcity that we do. So, and in that sense, maybe it will also make sense to form partnerships with other regions and economies that they face the same concerns, rather than going into a race where European Union might be in a disadvantaged position because we are not as rich in resources as in other countries. So these are three of the multitude of challenges that I think that the next political cycle and the next elected members of the parliament will need to face.
Well, we have to cross our fingers that they will. Thank you, Vasilia, for sharing your expertise and insights with us today. It was a truly enlightening conversation.
Thank you, Panagiotis. It was really a pleasure. And it's happy to see the interest on this topic, to be honest. Also going beyond people traditionally involved in sustainability issues. I think this is very encouraging. Yeah.
I would also like to thank our audience for tuning in and engaging with these important topics. Your support and interest make the Global Greek Influence podcast worthwhile.
Thank you all for staying until the end. Subscribe, follow, and leave a review to show your support and spread the podcast message far and wide. Thank you for being part of the Global Greek Influence podcast family. Stay tuned and keep exploring the world of podcasts with the Global Greek Influence.